Let's call a meeting in order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:50, Tuesday, March 31. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. Present: Representative Culver, Representative Ledoux, Representative Lane, Representative Tuck, Representative Hughes, and myself, Bob Heron, and Representative Grunberg is down the hall. Should be coming to us very quickly here. The only business item today is House Bill 126, Code of Military Justice. And we, when we adjourned at the last meeting, we were in discussion. We had adopted a CS, the hotel version, and we had moved amendment number one by Representative Culver. Representative Ledoux objected, so amendment number one is still before us. Also, for questions only, I don't think we have anybody signed up to testify, is Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole is on the line. Captain Jennifer King, Judge Advocate, is available as well. Nancy Mead from Ledge Liaison Court System, Tom Dosick, Department of Law, and Tracy Wallenberg from Public Defender, all available for questions if we need to. We may, we'll open it up here in a bit for public testimony and then close public testimony. But, First Lieutenant, could you come up and place yourself on the record?
Yes, sir, for the record, this is First Lieutenant Forrest Dunbar.
Okay, thank you, Lieutenant. The committee has amendment number one in front of them. So, Lieutenant, could you please explain the amendment?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, this is an amendment that, thank you, expands the pool of people who can serve in certain capacities, specifically as judge advocates. As we discussed a little bit at the last hearing, the Alaska National Guard has relatively few judge advocate resources. So there are some cases where our officers are conflicted or otherwise unavailable, and we want to be able to go forward with these proceedings with courts martial. To do that, we would like to be able to draw upon resources from other National Guards or from the active duty components. And that's the intention of the amendment. Would you also like me to speak to the legal memo that was prepared? I know that was raised during the last hearing.
Yes, please go ahead.
So if the committee members have the memo from Kathleen Strasbaugh regarding this amendment, she asked a number of questions. I spoke with her and as well as the committee staffers about this. So for example, in the second to last paragraph, she said, did you intend to include NOAA and PHS officers? And will they have military court experience? The answer is yes, we did intend this. We wanted it to be as broad as possible. We were particularly concerned about allowing Coast Guard officers to serve. But I would stress that this is only in cases where we feel it's necessary, and it would still be overseen by the senior force judge advocate. So we wouldn't be requesting the services of anyone who hadn't had experience or we felt was qualified to act as counsel in these matters. However, we don't want to be constrained by the law. We don't want there to be a situation where there's someone in uniform service who could do a good job, who we know is qualified, but we are constrained by the law and not allowed to use them as a resource. So the answer to that question is yes, that was our intention. The second set of questions regards that following paragraph. There are three sections she speaks about there. One of those is an error. We already had resolved that. The two others, the answer, she has kind of a double negative in here, but she wanted to know if we wanted to expand it in a particular way, and the answer is no. So the bill doesn't expand it in a different section in a very particular way, and we didn't intend it to. So there is no error there. And then the last one, she speaks about it might be possible for all judges and attorneys connected with a court-martial, except for the Appeals Commission, to be from out of state. Is our intention to allow for that? The answer to that is yes. We are comfortable with all of the attorneys potentially being from out of state. The important thing to remember, though, is that the commander will be bringing these charges, and the Appeals Commission would be Alaskan. So there always would be a very strong Alaskan component to this proceeding. But for the formal part of the court's martial, we're comfortable having resources from out of state. So I think we have addressed all the concerns of the memo, and there are no concerns in the memo that are raised that aren't addressed by the amendment. I'll put it that way.
Yes. Any questions? Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You lost me in the second part of the maze.
It's kind of complicated, but basically...
The second part, through the chair.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Greenberg. It has to do with the definition of force. So there's an issue about whether...
Maybe I can focus this a bit. Save time. Is the answer to Ms. Strasbaugh's question in that paragraph? You did not request that the statutes be amended to allow a military judge or judge advocate from another force to be detailed to preside or be appointed as counsel. Is it the intent to allow a military judge or judge advocate from another force to be detailed to preside or be a judge advocate? Just a yes or no.
No. So the key word in there is actually another force. So I was confused about what she was asking as well. It had to do with the definition of force as she reads it has to do with the Alaska the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard and whether there could be sort of cross-pollinization between the two. And so she wanted to know if we wanted to expand it, was my understanding, to allow for the senior judge advocate from that's not how she's phrased this. The way she phrased this question is not the conversation we had or I understood. Because a simple reading of this, we've already done that. But not with respect to 2605-590-21, which refers to the senior force judge advocate. So it had issues with the senior force judge advocate. There's one for the Air National Guard. There's one for the Army National Guard. And she was worried that we wanted to expand it further, but we don't need to. That's basically what the upshot is.
I think this must be my day for confusion.
The answer is no. She wants to know if we want to expand it further. The answer is no.
We don't, and we don't want to.
That's right. Okay.
If I may follow up.
Okay.
If you look at the previous paragraph, I'd like these if I could dialogue through the chair, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair.
Thank you. Looking up at the third full paragraph on page one, second sentence, the UCMJ applies to NOAA and PHS staff, quote, when they are in service to the armed forces, unquote. That is a big qualifier because normally NOAA is nowhere near the armed services and normally the PHS is nowhere near the armed services. So does the text make that clear? Because otherwise we need to make that extremely clear. That's usually only like in wartime, very special circumstances.
So Representative Greenberg, through the chair, what she's referring to there is the UCMJ applying to them, but we're not dealing with whether or not the UCMJ applies to them. What we want to do is be able to use uniformed officers in those two services, regardless of whether or not they are at war, for example, and bring them in to serve on our behalf as judge advocates.
May I continue, please?
So your question, Representative Gruber, is the last, do you intend to include those officers?
Yeah.
The answer is yes.
And a follow-up. I thought that we were limiting the folks involved in these courts martial to people who are basically in the armed services in one form or another. Here we're taking docs from the native hospital or NOAA people who may be, for some reason, coming through on a ship that occasionally ties up in Juneau, people who have absolutely nothing to do with the UCMJ, and putting them on courts martial and stuff like that. I don't even know if the Public Health Services has lawyers. I don't even know if the NOAA does, and if they are, whether any of them are anywhere near Alaska.
Representative Kronberg, to the chair. So I think the distinction here is important to keep in mind is this doesn't apply to who may serve on courts martial in respect to who may be on the panel. And nothing in here conscripts those people. What it says is if we had someone, let's say we had a NOAA officer who lived in Alaska, who had been a judge advocate at a different point in their life, and was currently working for NOAA here in the state, we would have the option to ask them to serve as a judge advocate, because the pool of judge advocates is much smaller than the overall pool of officers and enlisted for the armed services. So nothing in here conscripts anyone, nothing in here requires anyone. It simply says if there happens to be an individual who happens to be living and working in Alaska and is otherwise qualified, and our senior judge advocate knows that they're otherwise qualified and they have some relevant experience, then we can ask them to take part.
May I, please?
Through the chair. Go ahead.
When you talk about judge advocate, you're talking about a lawyer rather than as a judge, right?
Through the chair, yes.
Do you know whether there would be any people who would actually qualify? I wouldn't think there'd be many NOAA people around. I think that's a relatively reaching quite a bit. And I'm wondering whether, and if there's anybody from Public Health Service, if there are any lawyers around, they'd probably be experts in health law and administration, nothing to do with this criminal stuff.
So Representative Greenberg, through the chair, I think you are correct. I think that the chances of us using this provision are relatively low because the pool of people is very small. We simply want to have the ability, if the eventuality presents itself. But I think you're correct. I think the chances of us using this provision, that part of this provision, are low.
Yes, sir. Through Representative Bloomberg, this question is from a constituent of mine. So I put it on the record. I think that the likelihood of it actually happen are extremely low. Unless you want to amend it where it prohibits it, I think we should move on.
I'm not about to offer an amendment on this on the fly. I would just like the folks and you, Lieutenant, to think about whether we'll deal with this later. I don't know enough about it, but I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to offer an amendment. Thank you. Glad we clarified that.
Okay. Is there any other questions for the Lieutenant on the proposed amendment? Representative Ledoux, do you maintain your objection?
No, I'd like to remove my objection.
Okay, the amendment is in front of the committee. Is there any objections, Representative Greenberg?
Just for the record, I'll bring this up in the next committee. We'll figure what we're going to do.
Yep, thank you. Seeing no other objection, amendment number one is adopted. So let's move to amendment number two. Representative Tuck, you want to move with the amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number two, 29.
I'll object for the purpose of this discussion. Representative Tuck, you have the floor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. In our last meeting, there was discussion on the courts martial, and it was noted that there was a drafting error in leaving out the section related to who may serve on courts martial. What this amendment will do is set out the procedure for who may serve on a courts martial, which includes a commissioned officer of the state militia or an active duty component of the armed forces of the United States, a warrant officer of the state militia or active duty of the armed forces of the United States, and an enlisted member of the state who is not a member of the same unit of the accused. This amendment we discussed with First Lieutenant Dunbar, and was approved by the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I would like to allow Lieutenant Dunbar to speak to it.
Lieutenant, please.
So Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to echo what Representative Tuck said. This was a provision that was in HB 121, which we had intended to bring over to HB 126, but oversight on my part didn't come over, so we'd like to add it now. It defines who may serve on the panel of the court's marshal. We have also altered this language from the language that came originally, I believe, from the National Guard Bureau in a way similar to the previous amendment. That is, we've expanded the pool. It used to be you had to be a member of the Guard to serve on these panels. Now we're saying a Guard or the active duty component for the same reason, because we have relatively few people in our Guard, and because also, especially if it's a high-ranking individual, we very quickly conflict out the people that are qualified to serve on the panel. You have to be, the people on the panel have to be of a higher rank than you. So if you have, for example, an 06 colonel or someone like that who is being court-martialed, you know, as you can imagine, with all the 06 colonels know each other in the National Guard. There just aren't that many of them. So we want to be able to draw upon the active duty component and other guards. Speaking to what Representative Gruenberg brought up before, this does not expand to NOAA, for example, or PHS, and the reason is because, unlike in the case with the pool, is much larger for officers and enlisted men more generally than it is for just JAG, judge advocate qualified individuals. And another example of how this has worked in the past, for the administrative separation hearings that happened over the summer and some earlier than that, I know of cases where we had to request senior enlisted or officers from other guards or from the active duty component for exactly this reason, because we were conflicted out. So the Guard worked with Representative Tuck on this amendment, and we would ask that it is also passed.
Yes, sir. Representative Hughes.
Just from my understanding, and maybe other people are aware of this, but for the court martial, can we call it a panel? Is that a correct term? And how many people would be on that?
Representative Hughes, through the chair. Yes, a panel can be thought of as a jury, I would say, except that a jury is probably a reasonable analogy. In a general court-martial, it is 5 members. For a special court-martial, it is 3 members.
Can follow up?
Yes, please.
And very briefly, because I know it doesn't pertain, so just for our understanding, what's the difference between special and general?
A general court-martial is a larger affair, more serious crimes, typically more serious offenses, rather. They can give out more serious punishments, penalties up to 10 years, a dishonorable discharge, whereas a special court-martial is smaller, and it is more limited in what kinds of penalties it can impose, and it's typically for less serious offenses.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the First Lieutenant? Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I read this is if you have a general court-martial, you have, as I understand it, 5 members on the panel?
That is correct.
Okay. So, and I'm looking here, paragraph D. Enlisted would have to make up at least 1/3, so that would mean 2 of the 5. You're nodding for
that. I'm thinking about the math. I suppose that is true, Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. Yes.
It was when I left.
no partial human beings.
Yes.
Okay. Now, on line 20, it says, without enlisted members, do you mean that without any enlisted members or without 1/3 of the enlisted members? Because you could have a circumstance where there was only one. I assume you would want the written explanation if there were less than 1/3.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, yes, that is correct. It is always our desire to have enlisted members on the panel if they're requested, and we have to give written reasons why if there is exigent circumstances that prevent us from doing so.
I'm not talking about what you say. I'm talking about when this comes into play.
Right.
So I think since that's ambiguous, we need to have in there a modifier, and I should say conceptually, without the required minimum number of enlisted members or something like that, because that way you'd have to have the notice if there was only one. And I'll be prepared to make that at the appropriate time as an amendment. Okay. The amendment, and through the chair, I guess I'd say the administration, and I guess the sponsor here too, have any objection to such an amendment, to clarify it?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, I don't believe that would be our interpretation anyway, so I don't believe we do not have any opposition to that.
Okay, if I'm...
So what I'd recommend is that you save the qualifier for the next committee referral, because you'll probably have a batch of amendments so you can deal with it.
I have no problem. We can do that there. Sure.
We'll call it. It'll be a housekeeping measure.
Okay. May I continue?
Please. Go ahead.
Okay. Then on the second page, we have the phrase best qualified on line 4. Who makes the determination? I assume the convening authority to determine who's best qualified. How is that reviewable? I mean, somebody could say they're best qualified because I know they're hanging high, or because they won't convict anybody. How do you determine who's best qualified? Is it just you look at who's got the highest education, who's the youngest, who's trained in guerrilla warfare, what?
Representative Krimberg, through the chair, I do believe it is at the discretion of the convening authority. However, Deputy Commissioner Dole is online, or Captain King, they might be able to give a more thorough answer in this regard.
Deputy Commissioner, are you online?
We are.
Yes. Go ahead. Please answer the question.
Could you restate it once to make sure I understand it?
Sure. Through the chair. This is Max Grunberg. Who determines what's blessed, quote, best qualified?
Line 4, page 2 of the Second Amendment.
And how do they determine it?
Is it of the panel members?
Yes.
Through the chair, to Mr. Grunberg, Representative Grunberg, are we speaking about how a panel member, or how a panel or people who preside on a panel are chosen?
Yes, I'm looking at paragraph F, as in Foxtrot, on page 2.
It differs for each convening authority, but in the three convening authorities that I had worked with, essentially you are provided a list, the JAG creates a list through the personnel section of all individuals who could sit on a panel, which is typically determined by the date of rank of the accused. And whether or not the accused elected to have all officers or a mix of enlisted. And then essentially the commander will go through, the convening authority will go through that list and will have the ERBs and the ORBs of each person that could be a potential panel member, and will select that way.
So, Captain, can you put yourself on the record? Please state your name.
I'm sorry, this is Captain Jennifer King. I'm with the Alaska Army National Guard. I am one of the JAGs, the Judge Advocates.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
What's an ERB or an ORB? I'm not sure about acronyms.
Through the chair, it is an enlisted record brief or an officer record brief. It typically holds information about our schooling, when we achieved different ranks, if we were deployed. It has information on whether or not we have dependents. If we've elected to put our religious preference on there, it will have that. So it has a wide range of information on this one document.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Are there any standards, particularly if you're looking at something like religion?
through the chair to Representative Grunberg. If a panel member is chosen based on faith, my guess is that could be challenged by either attorney, and there will be the opportunity for the defense counsel as well as the government counsel to receive the panel questionnaires. So those get sent out. They will receive the questionnaires. They can ask whether or not there have been considerations based upon like preferences, religious or otherwise. That usually happens during voir dire of the panel.
I guess maybe I should pursue this in the next committee, but I'm going to be interested in knowing what the standards are for this, and particularly if the convening authority is then the first level of appeal, and the person who's going to be the appellate reviewer chooses who's on based on some qualification. I think we'll just reserve that, but I'll put you on notice. And finally, on line 12, page 2, Lieutenant, or either Lieutenant, I guess. What's a, quote, principal assistant? Is that a paralegal?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I actually am not familiar with that particular phrase. Captain King, ma'am, are you familiar with the term principal assistant?
The
paragraph G, the last line on page 2.
Paragraph G. Maybe I don't.
We have a different version.
I have a different version. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's all right. We'll... this is an interim project by the Judiciary Committee anyway, this legislation. So, Representative Goodman, you and the First Lieutenant will become fast friends this summer.
I'm sorry, I should probably have not gotten down in the weeds, but I'm not down to the roots yet, but we'll get there.
Okay, have you concluded your question?
Yeah, I don't have an objection to number two.
So, is there any other questions on amendment number two for the First Lieutenant? I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objections to adopting amendment number two? Seeing none, it's adopted. Representative Tuck, you want to move the next amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number three.
Object for discussion, please. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is another oversight that just from taking language into a committee substitute. We have on page 37, line 31, I was just asking to delete may and insert shall.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And if you look on page 3, we have similar language there.
Mm-hmm. I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objections? Yes, Representative.
No objections. Can you please tell us, or maybe the First Lieutenant can, what the shall adopt regulations to implement, and then it gives a set of statutes. So what are we changing? Shall adopt statutes pertaining to what? Or regulations to what?
The regulate, I believe, sorry, Representative Hughes through the chair.
Is it the whole?
It's most of the act, the regulations, most of the regulations. And we want to be bound, frankly. We want it to be a shall, not a may. We want future commands to be required to create and enforce these regulations, and I think that's the intention of Representative Tuck. We've had conversations about this before, so we also support this amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no objections, amendment number three is adopted. Is there any other? Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has just been, I'm sorry I don't have something drafted, but just for consideration. When we look at regulations shall be drafted by the department. And we look at what's going to be drafted. We have adjudication by court martial or non-judicial punishment. We have maximum limits applicable state and federal law identifying punishment if authorized by the military offenses identified under 3 of the subsection. I'm just reading from page 3 of the bills, lines 9 through 13, which is section 2605380, regulations adopting code of military justice, and looking at subsection B with item 3 and 4. So that's a lot of power given to the agency in drafting those regulations. So I would like to do a conceptual amendment, Mr. Chair. On page 4, removing subsection C, lines 1 and 2, the regulations adopted under this section are exempt from AS 4462, the Administrative Procedure Act. So the whole question is, first of all, when it comes to people being criminalized, being court-martialed, whether any agency has the authority to draft that. Usually that's all written in statutes. Criminal code is in statutes. And we're given the shall adopt regulations. If we're going to do that, then I think that it's very important that we do follow regulations code that we already have established in statute. In looking through this chapter on 4462, we have procedures. First, there has to be consistency between regulations and statute that's existing. We have submitting regulation to Lieutenant Governor for prior approval. We have the style and forms. The Department of Law will be involved from the beginning, so they'll prepare and revise along the way, and they will, through the regulated making authority, the Department of Law will be involved all the way through that. I mean, that's how all of our regulations currently are being handled. And the Department of Law shall advise the agencies on legal matters relevant to the adoption of regulations that may advise the agencies in need for and policy involved in particular regulations. We got to look at making sure that we're following the state constitution in a lot of this. And then going on through just the public online notice system and making sure that if you're not going to have things printed in a newspaper, published in a newspaper, that you do have that online, because one of the problems that we've seen in the past is that things have been less than transparent. Things have been arbitrarily decided within the department, and my concern is that by having the authority, given that much of authority to a department with no oversight whatsoever, that we may end up in the same situation that we were once before. We're not really fixing the problem, we're just kind of masking it. So, and then going on further, the contents of the notice will need to be in there, and whether these hearings are publicly noticed if they're held in the open meetings or are they executive sessions. Those are defined. And I think for such an important piece of legislation, for such an important process that we're undertaking, that I think it's really important that we have the transparency and oversight that is required of any other agency.
Yes, Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I have a question, so just so I understand that right now, if your conceptual amendment were not adopted, during the interim, there would be folks from the Guard and such working on the set of regulations. So what you're proposing would be that would happen and then we'd go through a public hearing process, or that we would, the Administrative Procedure Act process would replace what the previous plan was as far as the military working on it separately? Or are you seeing the military working on it separately and then those being put out for the public and going through the process?
Okay, if I missed me, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Tuck.
So, and that's the big fundamental question, really, is we were saying they shall adopt regulations to deal with court martials and so on and so forth. But we're not telling them how they should adopt the regulations. Now, one of the things that I see happening, and the reason why I didn't really think about this, I'm comfortable with us going down that process of designing regulations, but when it comes to actually implementing what goes in regulations and what goes in the law is where I have a little bit of concern. Now, in the interim, as we work through this, as we develop our Uniform Code of Military Justice, I expect that we will have transparency, we will be working together on things, things will mold and shape into something that we will feel very comfortable with. But from that day forward, I'm concerned about what happens by excluding the Military Code of Justice, or I'm sorry, the Department of Military Veterans Affairs from the regulations process. So how I envision this taking place, if I may, Mr. Chair, is that we will all work together, let the department take on the heavy in developing regulations that they know best to do for themselves. We overlook it, we take a glance, we exercise dialogue, and then we determine what goes in statute, what remains in regulations, and then from that day forward, that we have an administrative code for changing any of those regulations that we don't think that needs to go in statute. But I do believe that when you have the authority to imprison someone for 10 years or to be able to dishonorably discharge them, there should be stuff in statute that just can't be arbitrarily changed without a public process, without people noticing.
Can we follow up?
Yes, please.
That is more a process, because I understood your reasoning. You've articulated that well. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, the DMVA, the Guard would be continuing to do like they were going to do anyway, and then those would be put out through the public process, noticed, and public hearings, which then, if I may just throw in another little question here, I am just concerned about public input where somebody doesn't really understand the military processes and have a full understanding weighing in, and how that might impact. That would be one question that I would have. And then I guess I would ask that those that drafted, whether it's the first lieutenant or Representative Ledoux, why see on the top of page 4 was in there, the lines 1 and 2, why were they exempt from the Administrative Procedure Act? So I have an understanding of the reasoning that was drafted that way in version H.
Before we go to Representative Ledoux, Representative Tuck, can you memorialize this on your letterhead, this, what your thoughts, so that people can take time to read and understand what you're asking the process to do?
Sure.
That'd be better for us.
Yeah, I'd be more happy.
Both to General Hummel, the First Lieutenant, and to the committee members, just put it on so we can read it. Okay. I'd appreciate it. Representative Ledoux?
I was just going to say that I am not necessarily adverse to the suggestions from Representative Tuck. And this is definitely something that I want to look at over the interim. And I think you've got some very, very good criticisms of this. I mean, on the other hand, however, this is a little bit different than somebody simply being a civilian being picked up off the street for a crime and not knowing what he's in for. Everybody who joins the military or joins the National Guard knows that there are certain laws and certain procedures that are applicable to the military or the National Guard. So just keeping those considerations in mind, as I say, I'm not adverse to thinking about this, working on this during the interim, and maybe changing things.
Okay. And if I may, Mr. Yep. Chair.
Reply.
Okay, so I'm going to withdraw this amendment. First, I would like to make a quick statement on it. I would hope that later on down the road, we do consider this amendment. but I don't want to put procedures in place to limit the department's ability to start writing regulations so we can quickly get a uniform code of military justice put together so we can have something to vote on next year. However, when it comes up next year, that's when we need to make the decision on whether or not, from that point forward, that they should follow the administrative code so that we have Lieutenant Governor's eyes looking at it, we have the legislature's eyes looking at it, and things can't just be arbitrarily changed without some sort of public process. Now, when it comes to the public process and people being able to weigh in, I don't imagine that too many public members outside of the department will be weighing in, but we have about 4,000 employees underneath the Department of Military Veterans Affairs that it will affect. And when those things are due to regulation, it's kind of like a company policy in many ways. They're a huge employer, that department, and a lot of the problems that we've seen in the past had to do with employment issues more than it had to do with criminal issues, and those things should be in regulations. So I'm going to remove my amendment with hopefully the intention as we go down this path that we all work together, we're able to expediently get some regulations put in play to eventually determine what should go in the law, what should remain in regulations, and how we proceed from that day forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just for the record, though, Representative Tuck, the conceptual amendment was not offered. You, so there was no conceptual amendment. It was a stream of consciousness. I know that, and that's when I asked if you could memorialize it and put it on the record so everybody understands where we're going, and then the process will generate the appropriate dialogue. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. I've given it some thought too, and talk to the lieutenant and some other folks, including the general. I am really concerned about exempting regs from the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. When I was in law school, this was a big subject of administrative law, which was a course in and of itself. And I will be very, very strong to keep this under the APA. There are ways we can, I think, accomplish what Representative Tuck has suggested and what you have both suggested. And in a nutshell, I have a thought, and I'm going to just sort of share my stream of consciousness with you. And correct me if I'm leaving something out. Regulations could be adopted, and maybe we would have the initial crime list run through the legislature, because it's serious that, number one, if somebody's going to be in jail for 10 years, it's not an agency that's determining it, at least without any legislative involvement. But ultimately, if there are regulations, they could be adopted through the Administrative Procedures Act, which is what's called a rulemaking function of the agencies. Agencies often have quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative or rulemaking, and this involves both of them here in this particular bill. The crimes could be listed in a regulation, but normally the regulation would not take place until the end of the next legislative session. And the report, the regulations, would be referred immediately to the appropriate committee. And that committee could have hearings, take any action, and it goes through the process. Under our Constitution, if there are regulations, they can only be amended or repealed by a statute. That's a couple of Supreme Court cases hold that. And that way, the legislature could, if they wanted to repeal them or disapprove them, is what it's called, they would pass a statute. If they wanted to send a different message, they could do it by a regulation. Or if the committee itself wanted to let the sense of the committee know, they could write an official letter by motion to the department. But it would give enough time for the legislature to act if they needed to disapprove the process. I mean, that's a way it could be accomplished. And I'm thinking I may draft something to do that.
Yes, Representative
Ledoux. Yes, can I ask a Representative Greenberg through the chair a question?
Please, go ahead.
So, can't an agency under our current laws rescind a regulation?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm talking about if they wouldn't. I mean, and that's why, through the chair, if I may dialogue for a minute, that's why we would have the other mechanism, either by an informal letter or something like that, asking them to do it, or a resolution. But twice in the 1980s, there was a Senator Paul Fisher from Kenai who wanted to be able to deal more quickly with regulations. He thought there were a number of regulations that were not good. And this line of Supreme Court cases said you cannot amend a regulation unless it's a bill, which would allow the governor to veto and keep his own regulations in place. And a lot of us thought that was kind of unfair. So twice they put it on the ballot to a constitutional amendment to allow the legislature to repeal regulations by a resolution. And Grace Burg-Scheibel, who was the Attorney General at the time, and some other people opposed it. The voters turned down that constitutional amendment twice.
Okay. We're in committee discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add that underneath Statute 4462.213, then there's other places too, but I guess this is a quick way of looking at definition. But anytime we talk about regulatory action, the definition is adoption, amendment, or repeal of a regulation also. So once we have things approved, we just don't want to see things come off the books unknowingly also. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're in the committee discussion. Any comments from anyone? Seeing none.
Yes, just one thing. The amendment itself only dealt with a transitional provision, changing the may to shall there. But ultimately, this thing at the top of page 4 is permanent, and we're going to have to look at that. And I look forward to working with the chair and the lieutenant and anybody else.
Before I go to Representative Culver here for the motion, this is probably our last meeting of the year. You know, we're getting down to the we're going to be meeting every day, and but if something comes up, we'll of course be able to do it. And I wish to thank everyone for your work this year, especially to the department on this particular issue, but we've done some other work in committee that's been pretty good, so I just want to say thanks. So seeing no other questions or comments, Representative.
Well, I'd just like to say,
yes,
Mr. Chair, I'd like to congratulate you on the very good work that you have done here. Very complicated subject, very important subject, and you've done a real good job, and we'll be working on this in cooperation with you.
Thank you for me. A couple accolades from me as well, Mr. Chair. I just got to say that it is refreshing to be working with very smart, intelligent, open-minded people in trying to correct and trying to improve the image of our National Guard. And
I thought you were talking about the legislature.
Yeah, the legislature. Yeah, and any way you can help us on that one too, please step forward. And I also want to thank the Judiciary Chair for working with us as well and her staff and team. I think we're going to have a very good product. It's something that other states would envy. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
And I just wanted to thank First Lieutenant Dunbar as well as my staffer Thomas Brown and the minority leader. I mean, this really all is going to be a team project. And it's a bipartisan team project. And while we may have some differences at this point as to how to put this together, everybody wants to make this, you know, a great bill.
Yes, Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just am grateful for all the aforementioned people as well working together as a team, and grateful to be a part of this in a small way, because I think this is very important to the Alaskan public. This last year we heard that outcry, and I think that it's very timely, and I appreciate all the people that are working on it, and thank you for what you've done so far.
Yeah, and I concur, and please send along our appreciation to the general that this is all hands-on deck effort.
Yes, sir.
Representative Culver?
I just to echo the comments here. It's a very important bill, very much needed to kind of bring back faith in our system and of justice in the military as well as civilians for folks that are looking to join up, that they will be safe and be treated fairly. So wish this bill luck in the next committee of referral. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would offer this, I would move committee substitute for House Bill 126 as amended, version 29-LS0473/H, with three accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations, to move out of committee.
Seeing no objection, the committee's on. We're just going to sign the committee report, and we're adjourned at 2:40. Thank you.